I've taken the part mostly on the street level to be able to identify the different assassins used in many of these different operations, to be able to link them so that people will start seeing that there's a very clear pattern and come that they're actually connected. Also that, I mean, they're active to this very day. So if you want to, we could go back to, I can just start describing a little bit about this team of assassins and how they've been involved in different operations.
Okay. We've only got a few minutes left, so if you want to wrap us up and round it off with that, I'd be much obliged.
Okay. If it's only a few minutes, I'll just do it very quickly. Like, the group I'm talking about was called Operation 40. It was started in the early 1960s or late 1950s, and it was under the surveillance of President Dwight Eisenhower. He gave the CIA chief, Alan Dulles, the task to, together with Richard Nixon, Vice President Richard Nixon, to form a team of assassins that could be used globally to take out whoever they had problems with. And this group was put together with mostly exiled Cubans, but also CIA operatives. And in this group, since we only got a few minutes, I won't go into the names, but many of the people.
By the way, you can take as much time as you want, and I'll just upload an extended little broadcast. But I know that you're short on time as well, so don't hold back on anything that you actually feel is relevant and important. And I'll give you as much time and as space as you need.
Okay, thanks, Vince. Okay, this group was put together, like I said, under the supervision of Richard Nixon, Vice President Richard Nixon. And the man put in charge to do the funding of or funnel the funds from the military-industrial complex, from the mob and from other groups was a man by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush. That's George Bush Sr. Now, George Bush Sr. was, his father was Prescott Bush, who was part of doing exactly the same, but doing the funding for Adolf Hitler, keeping the whole Nazi war machine going. Because this global elite wanted the Second World War to go, and keep going. Anyway, George Bush was involved with the funding of it, and his right hand that was given was a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez. Now, Felix Rodriguez was a high CIA operative as well, because they had tops from the CIA involved in this group, like Ted Shackley, the Blonde Ghost, David Attlee Phillips, and E. Howard Hunt, which was later one of the Watergate burglars. The whole Watergate burglary was done to cover up this group's involvement in this JFK assassination. So the people that was doing the burglary, all of them were part of the Operation 40. Now, when they started this, the main aim was to kill Fidel Castro. But then in the meantime, they did several attacks on Fidel Castro, but in the end they failed. And in the meantime, JFK became a bigger threat. So what was done was that this cannon that they had created with, like there were between 40 and 86 members most of the time of these highly skilled assassins that was trained in guerrilla warfare and many other ways of assassinate people with bombs and poison and all of these things. While when they couldn't get to Fidel Castro, like I said, JFK became the current problem. So they just changed the cannon and aimed it at him instead. And in Dealey Plaza, the shooters that was there were sent. Most of them came from Operation 40, and then with a mob. Putting in their shooters as well. So if I can go quickly through in Dealey Plaza, who were the shooters? In the Daltex building, the shooter was a man by the name of Chucky Nicoletti. He was the hitman from the Chicago mob, and he was supplied by Chicago mob leader Sam Giancana, who was actually staying at the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas that day as well. The shooter was Chucky Nicoletti, and the spotter. They always have two or three people in the team. There's one shooter, one spotter. The spotter is sort of checking out the area. He's also checking out the escape routes and so on. And sometimes there's a breakdown guy as well who takes over the gun, who takes the shells. get rid of all kind of evidence that is in the location and gets rid of it as soon as possible after the shooting. Anyway, in this case, the spotter, his name was Nestor Izquierdo. He was a member of Operation 40 as well. And in the same room, it was the office in the Daltex building where the shots came from was a CIA front, a mining company. In that office that day was George Bush Sr., as well, the funding guy and later the president of the United States. Were in that. Together there was one more man called Johnny Rosselli. He was the liaison between the government, the CIA, and the Chicago mob, or the different mobsters, because it was not only the Chicago mob, it was also the Miami mob, some parts from New York, and the Louisiana, where you got Carlos Marcelo. Santos Traficante in Miami, Carlos Marcelo, and Sam Giancana were one of the main ones in this hit. Okay, so that was the Daltex building. When you go up to the school book depository, the Texas school book depository, where Lee Harvey Oswald was claimed to have been shooting from, the so-called sniper's nest, the actual shooter in that sniper's nest, his name was Eladio Del Valle. He was a member of Operation 40, a former secret informer for the Batista regime on Cuba. And the spotter in that window was a man by the name of Herminio Diaz Garcia, a black mercenary who was also part of Operation 40. Then on the western, the sixth book floor on the in the Texas School Book Depository is one made big room. And in the opposite end of the room, at that window, there was another shooter. His name was Richard Kane. He was a former Dallas police officer who later became a lieutenant for Sam Giancana in Chicago. And he did the shooting from there. Anyway, you had, as far as I've been able to find out, Lee Harvey Oswald was absolutely not involved with this. He had been duped into thinking that his task was to infiltrate the group that was doing the assassination. And so he was actually there, I must say, as a hero, because he knew what he was up against. Not that he was going down as a patsy, but that he was actually risking his life to stop this whole thing. But I think his task was, he was on the second floor on the school book depository, and he was observed by one of the first police officers that ran into the building. He was observed very calmly standing drinking a Coca-Cola bottle, meaning that he could not have gone from the sixth floor down to the second floor in only 40 seconds without being totally out of breath. There were also people walking in the staircase, and nobody saw him there. So I believe that the reason why he was there was he was blocking the elevator so that the shooters on the sixth floor would not be disturbed during the whole hit. And he was standing right where this where you buy the Coca-Cola bottles, right. That was exactly where the elevator shaft came down. So his task was to stop them, to anyone to go up and use the elevator. And at the same time, the shooter later, just after the shootings, managed to get down inside the elevator shafts on ropes, since they were guerrilla trained fighters. That was the way they got out without anyone seeing them. Then when you go towards the grassy knoll, where the limo, the whole motorcade was slowed down by making, they made a change to the route, going into a route that totally broke all security rules, because it was first a very sharp 90-degree turn into Houston Street, and then a 120-degree turn onto Elm Street. And if you look at Dealey Plaza from above, for one thing, there's an obelisk. And for another thing is that it's an absolute pyramid shape, where the hit was done almost at the top of the pyramid. Coincidence? I don't know. I'm just pointing it out. And also, so when we go further down the grassy knoll, there was in the grass, there's one guy standing with an umbrella. black umbrella, and it's been speculated that inside this umbrella there were some poison darts or something like that. In my opinion, absolutely not. His task was to show the exact spots for the crossfire, because they had so many different shooters and everyone was supposed to shoot at the same time, otherwise it couldn't be blamed on one single patsy. If there were like 20 shots fired, you could never blame it on one guy. So he was the one. His task was to just show where the shot should be fired. His name was Roy Hargraves. He was very closely associated to Operation 40. And the person in front of him, there's a guy standing waving right when the limo passes, dark Cuban man. As far as I and many other researchers have been able to identify, his name was Felipe Vidal Santiago, very closely connected to the Operation 40 as well. And this guy was later working under the name, the false identity of Charles Morgan. He was working for a CIA front company called ITT. And this was in 1963. But 1985, just a few months before the hit on the Swedish Prime Minister, he was in Stockholm trying to recruit assassins for that hit. And his job over the years had been to go to different countries and recruit assassins for different jobs. So here you can see there's one direct link between these two assassinations. Okay, on the street corner as well, on Dealey Plaza, when you go into towards Elm Street, one of the guys that you can see there, if you enlarge the photos, was a CIA operative, very high up, called David Morales. Now, this David Morales, he was part in this hit on JFK. He was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was killed, where he was there with two other very, very high CIA operatives, not doing the shootings, but being part of taking care of the whole operation. And he was also the one who later was sent to Bolivia together with Felix Rodriguez, the guy who helped George Bush with the funding of Operation 40. These two people were sent to Bolivia to try and track down Che Guevara, who was an accomplice or a partner of Che Guevara. And it was actually Felix Rodriguez who led a small patrol of military people. They tracked Che Guevara down, and the guy that was ordered to execute him was David Morales. Anyway, we go back to Dealey Plaza, and on the opposite side of the street, when you look at the Zapruder film, once the first shots are fired, look up in the right corner. There's very few people that have noticed this guy. It's a guy in light clothes with a big dark brown bulletproof vest. Very obvious once you see him, but you're so focused on the limo that no one looks at him. And this guy is a man by the name of Walter Tobinski. He was the guy, one of the guys I mentioned before, who's one of the worst serial killers in modern time. And as far as I know, I'm not sure if he's still alive, but he and his partner, Clyde Forshaw, have been very, very active to this very day. Anyway, he's also the guy who's been, they took photos of being an imposter of Lee Harvey Oswald. But when he came out from the Cuban and Russian embassy in Mexico City earlier on, there are clear photos of him. But this guy, if you look at him at the Zapruder film, you will see that he, just when the limo passes, he takes like a tactical stance, and he's got some kind of weapon firing something at the president. And according to himself, to one what one witness have told me, is that Walt Zabinski himself told that his task was to fire a tranquilizer, some kind of tranquilizer at the president to make him not be able to move so that the other people could finish the job with triangular fire. I don't know if that is true or not, but when you look at the Zapruder film, it makes a whole lot of sense, because his technical stand, he fires and then he lets his hand drops down to the sides. And in photos taken just a few minutes after the whole motorcade has passed, you can see this Walter Tobinski walk very slowly, very relaxed towards the school, Texas School Book Depository. Okay, so then we go down towards the grassy knoll, and if you there's like a wall, concrete white wall, and there's where the so-called badge man can be found. The badge man, or black dog, he's also called, is a man in a. It's been identified as he has a black Dallas police uniform on, and there's one photo where you can actually see where he fires right at the limo. Next to him, there's a railroad worker standing who took care of it. Once the shots were fired, he ran over to one of the bystanders who had been filming it, grabbed the film from this guy, then ran behind the picket fence, threw the rifle to the guy in the railroad clothes, who then took. He went behind sort of like an electric cupboard or whatever you want to call it, and bent down and took apart the guns very quickly, boom, boom, and put it into a toolbox, and then started walking slowly towards the railroad tracks where he went into. I don't know where he disappeared there from there on. But anyway, that police officer, or fake police officer, the so-called badge man, as far as I've been able to identify, his name was Lucien Sarti. He was an international hitman, very, very bold, very careless, which made him feared by many, but also made him one of the best people because he didn't, he was so unafraid of dangers. He was supplied by through Santos Traficante from Miami. He was the guy who got the Marseille mob to import this guy. They flew them to he and two accomplices to Mexico City. They then went up to Brownsville in Texas, crossed the border there, were picked up by a member of the Chicago mob and drove to and driven to Dallas some weeks before. Anyway, we go there. Also, next to them, to the right of these two people, if you see that they've reversed a car in, it's a white Oldsmobile, I think. And next to him, there's a shooter as well. You can see him in the Orville Nicks film very clearly if you know where to look for him. This guy, as far as I've been able to identify, is the person I spoke about before, Clyde Forshaw. Anyway, we go towards the picket fence, and on behind the picket fence is the guy that actually fired the final headshot. His name was James Files. He's still alive. He's in prison in Illinois, and he has come forward, not very easily. It's taken years for him to persuade him to come forward. But he did the final headshot. He was the driver for Chucky Nicoletti from, if you remember him, in the Deltex building. And he was only there to go there and supply the weapons and drive the escape car out of Dallas that day. But in just an hour or so before the assassination, there was the whole operation was supposed to be called off by some parts of the CIA. So Johnny Rosselli, who was the liaison, he got cold feet and said, "I'm not going to do the shooting. I back off." So then Chucky Nicoletti asked his driver, who had a very violent background, very skilled killer, if he would do him the honor taking part of that. So was fine with that and positioned himself behind the picket fence. There's a tree there. He was standing right to the right of it, if you look down from where the limo was. And the weapon he used was an XP-100 Remington Fireball. It was like a rifle pistol. It's a rifle, but made with a pistol grip and a short barrel. Very, very efficient weapon on a short distance, very accurate. And this was given to him by Ted Shackley from Operation 40 as well. Now, sorry, David Attlee Phillips from Operation 40. Now, this David Attlee Phillips is very, very interesting because he was the CIA handler of no one less than Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller and handler of James Files. And he was also the controller of a serial killer by the name of Michael Vernon Townley, who was later very integrated in a lot of different terror acts committed by Operation 40 and so on, and also was on location when the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme was killed in February 1986. yet another connection. It just goes on and on, but this is the general overview of what happened in Dealey Plaza this day. But it was so much bigger than that, because the whole way of how there was absolutely no protection of the prime minister. The limo was positioned right up in the front instead of in the middle of the motor cage. His private physician was placed at the very back of the motor cage. The press car that was normally positioned in front of the presidential limo to take photos, that was placed behind it, way back behind it, and so on. And the whole protection thing with military protection and so, which normally takes place like a month ahead, you know, when Secret Service goes to a new town and just checks out all the dangers and takes care of all of that. Nothing of all that was done. It just goes on and on and on. So, well, I can only say that many of these members in Operation 40 was later totally central in the whole Operation Contras Iran scandal, together with Oliver North and so on. They were also very central in what was called Operation Condor, which was tracking down Allende supporters. They were part of doing the overtake of Salvador Allende, and also later tracking down his supporters globally and doing killings there. They were also part of blowing up Orlando Letier at Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., which was a major, major terror act on American soil. And the parts of Operation 40 was later, like the one guy called Porter Goss, he was later the chief of the CIA under George Bush Jr. And he was also involved, quite a few of them are involved in the 9/11 attack as well. And it just goes on and on. So this Operation 40 has been called the grandmother of all operations. And it's been so central, even though it's changed names many times. It's gone under many different names of Pegasus and G2 and I don't know all the different names. But in fact, it's the same group of assassins that have been used and are still being used. Now they're training new ones. There are new generations coming up and so on. But many of them are still alive. And that was about it.
All right. Well, Ollie, it's been a pleasure and an honour and various other nice adjectives, mate. I actually really appreciate all your research that you want to lay down here, and also your humility to admit that you don't know everything, which is actually quite rare for very credible researchers, and I want to thank you for that. Fantastic.
You're welcome. Can I also say I'm looking to make a documentary, a top quality documentary about Operation 40, because it connects so many of these major terror acts that have been committed the last 50, 60 years. Mm. And so I'm really looking to try and get in touch with John Pilger or people on his caliber, documentary maker. I'm also, if people would like to help me, just like you, with donations or signing up for my newsletter or so on, it's extremely appreciated. If you don't know what to do, how you can help, support people like Vinny and myself, because without, it's very, very hard to feed your family at the same time as doing this type of research. So any type of support like that is extremely appreciated.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're hungry for the truth, I can assure you, you'll wind up going hungry because you can't afford the food, because nobody pays you very much for telling the truth. They do pay you a hell of a lot of money if you tell bullshit and kill people, on the other hand. I guess we're in the wrong business. All right. Thank you, Ollie. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for all your continued support and whatnot. And as I mentioned before, we've got like a $900 shortfall this week. So if you are capable of donating a significant chunk of change just to keep me on the air, you know, it's actually this close to the wire, ladies and gentlemen. I can't stress it enough. Wait, let's see. I think I just did with the tone of voice. Please help me. Please, you know, what do I have to do? Get down on my knees? I'm already sitting down, bro. Okay, well, thank you very much, Ollie. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening, and we'll see you again sometime, assuredly.
My absolute pleasure. You take care.
Cheers, mate.